Hi, and welcome to Women Who Travel. I'm Lale Arakoglu, and today I'm excited to explore the beauty industry of South Korea. During the pandemic, unable to travel, I found myself attempting to escape my teeny tiny apartment through really any medium. Foreign language movies, recipes from around the world, just about every type of music, and a lot of it came out of Korea. I was running to K-pop, watching Bong Joon-ho's Parasite like everyone else I knew, and teaching myself how to make bibimbap. I was also doing a ton of internet shopping, which meant spending far too much money on K-beauty. Today, my guest is Elise Hu. Elise is a broadcast journalist, author, and host of the podcast TED Talks Daily. She also has a new book out called Flawless, Lessons in Looks and Beauty from the Korean Capital. It's Elise's first book, and as a fellow journalist, I was curious to find out what it's like to go from reporting to writing an entire book dedicated to a single subject.
I've been a longtime journalist, of course, and I'm so used to spitting out stories that feel sort of ephemeral, and this is just a tangible thing, you know?
A little more final, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Can't go back and change it now.
Are you going to be doing any book tours or sort of traveling with the book?
Yes, it's a 10-city tour, and so hopefully I'll be in a city near you, wherever you are.
I love it. And you are in LA, right?
I'm in LA, but I love to travel, so this will be an interesting time. This will just be an interesting experiment in packing for various climates and trying to keep everything really light. I know this is something y'all probably talk about all the time, but just trying to be very light and sparing in my packing, but also have what I need in the various towns I'm going to be in.
Are you a packing cube person? I feel like that is, when it comes to like multi-city stops and different climates, I'm always told that that's the thing that's going to help the most, but I'm very disorganized, so I rarely get around to actually utilizing it.
I use packing cubes, but I don't organize what's in them. You know, I don't separate like, oh, this is for Dallas, and then this is for Boston. I use packing cubes just for space, just so it really stuffs. I can stuff so much stuff into a packing cube and then get it into my suitcase.
Back in 2015, Elise went to South Korea to start a news bureau for NPR in Seoul. What was your relationship to Korea before you went there to set up this bureau?
I knew very little. I obviously am an Asian American. My family is from China and Taiwan. And so I am familiar with the areas in which Korean and Japanese and Chinese culture overlap. And in many places, they do overlap. And so there were some sort of Northeast Asian ideas and cultural norms that I was quite familiar with that made it easier for me when I went abroad. And also, I speak Mandarin Chinese, and so many Koreans also speak Chinese that when they didn't speak English, we would use what I called the Chinese loophole. So I would try English, and then I'd try Chinese, and their Chinese would often be better than the English. And so we both of us non-speakers of the other language. So I was an English speaker who couldn't speak Korean, and then these Koreans didn't speak great English. So both of us were using, you know, our second languages of Chinese in order to communicate.
I love that.
These are the things that happen when you're abroad.
You get creative, right?
Kind of magical. Exactly. It's a good hack. The Chinese loophole.
I love it. Just using, any second language as a loophole. That actually, I used to have that with my grandmother who was Turkish, and she didn't really speak any English and I didn't really speak any Turkish, but she spoke fluent French and I had enough high school French.
Yep.
That we used to have these slightly bizarre phone conversations in sort of butchered French, at least on my end. She was very good.
It's just like that. It's totally just like that.
You know, as you do with anywhere that you kind of yearn to visit, I have a picture in my head of what it's like in Seoul, and I'm sure it's probably totally inaccurate.
I was watching Succession the other night.
Oh, I watched Succession.
Are you caught up?
I'm two episodes behind.
Okay. Well, this won't give anything away. This isn't anything plot related. It's actually just about Seoul specifically. The eccentric tech billionaire that's played by Alexander Sarsgaard, Lucas Mattsson, says to, I think, Kendall, the Roy sons, of New York, he was like, if you look down there, it looks like Legoland compared to Seoul. Seoul is humongous. It's incredibly dense. It's just all lights and sound and skyscrapers reaching high into the clouds. The air is often polluted. There's so many cars in the streets. There's just an amazing subway system that can get you anywhere, and you'll never have to lose your connection to whatever you're streaming, even deep in the bowels of the subway. You can get anything delivered to your door instantly, nearly instantly. It's electric. It's vibrant. It's made me feel like I was in a country that was sort of first world plus. But as a result of that, I feel like it masked a lot of some of the issues that I then got to see, some of the social issues that I then got to see and report on after I had stayed there longer. The skyscrapers reach high into the clouds and you can see mountains in the background, but you're also seeing just images of the same or similar looking ideal Korean woman everywhere. So you're seeing them on the sides of buses. You're seeing them on the sides of buildings. You're seeing them rush across you on the placards on top of cabs. And so it was really rather inescapable that I got a sense of what the ideal woman was supposed to look like.
When Elise went on her long-term assignment to Seoul, the beauty industry was hardly top of mind. In addition to setting up shop as bureau chief, she had her many reporting tasks. Investigating lead stories, researching, interviewing sources. She was wearing multiple hats. All of this is actually kind of similar to life as a travel writer, and it made me think of all the assignments that I've been on in search of new stories in hard-to-reach places. Like when I went to rural Japan and covered a story about women's hiking groups, only to end up walking through a forest with a mountain priestess. And while I do this for work, I'd argue that it's applicable to all sorts of travel. After all, isn't asking questions and being curious about a place what travel at its heart is all about?
I moved to Seoul in the beginning of 2015 and founded NPR's first bureau covering Northeast Asia. So it covered North Korea, South Korea, and Japan. And I was really instantly spit into one of the most unpredictable and chaotic global stories, North Korea, as it intersected with one of the most unpredictable and chaotic American presidents, Donald Trump, who was elected the year after I got there. So it was sometimes thrilling. It was frequently exhausting. It felt important. But there was this sense that you could never really take a breath. And as a result, I didn't get to ever take a comprehensive look at something that really nagged at me, which was the state of gender inequality in South Korea. South Korea has one of the lowest women's labor participation rates, one of the biggest gender pay gaps, and one of the lowest percentage of women in leadership positions in the developed world.
You did a lot of reporting for this book and also wove personal experience into it. How did the idea come to you?
It was really my unfinished business. I moved home in 2018, at the end of 2018, which was the same year of the top three largest women's rights rallies in South Korean history. The feminists of Korea are some of the most organized and can-do and just inspiring women in the world. And I think that they deserved a lot more attention for what they were trying to stand up against, which were really punishing standards for how women were supposed to look, but also women were supposed to behave. I never got to go to a single one of those rallies because that was the same year of tons of missile tests from North Korea, a rapid rapprochement between North Korea and South Korea. There was a unified Winter Olympics that year in Pyeongchang. There was an inter-Korean summit for the first time in many, many years between North and South. There was also a historic U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore that year between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, the first time a sitting U.S. president met with the North Korean head of state. That was all in 2018. So I really, by the time I got back, did not feel as though I covered the domestic women as well as I should have.
Although Elise wasn't writing about beauty when she was working for NPR, the advertising and messaging around the beauty industry hit her from day one.
When I got to Seoul, the first place that I stayed was this neighborhood called Myeongdong, which is the makeup and skincare district. It's where you have one makeup store after another, after another, after another. And the same brand name store can have three or four different locations just on the same block. So I write about how I could stand on a corner and see a face shop across the street from a face shop, across the street from a face shop.
Wait, what do you mean by face shop?
It's the name brand of a line of Korean beauty products. It's called The Face Shop. And they're known for all sorts of natural ingredient sheet masks, which were really hot at the time. And I think they were kind of new at the time for the rest of the world in 2015.
Elise shared with us some tapes she recorded. Here she is in the heart of Seoul at the global headquarters of the superstore, Amore Pacific.
We're in this vast, open lobby of Amore Pacific, where you feel really small, and then it's so new. There's granite, light gray granite, everything, and a spinning ring of moving words in English and in Hangul suspended in the air above a round, circular sign-in desk, like it's Star Trek, The New Generation, like the captain's command center. And then I came over to look at the guide to see which floor we're on, and the map of the 20 floors is a mirrored sign such that you can't avoid mirrors everywhere you go. Now I'm in the Amore headquarters, Amore shop, which is where they're selling products, hair, makeup, sun care, skin care products from all their lines. And I've stumbled into the hair color aisle where every hair color model is a member of Blackpink, the world's largest female girl group.
The bounty of Korean beauty products available to buy online can be overwhelming, even for those of us like me who are somewhat obsessed with skincare rituals. There are sheet mask formulas with snail serum, jelly-like moisturizers promising to make our skins look smooth and glowy, cleansing balms to open up our pores. It's almost like the more you know, the harder it is to figure out what's actually right for you. For Elise, this endless advice really hit her personally. More on that after the break. Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
There was this idea of transformation in the air and the idea that you can pay to transform yourself all around me. It also triggered in me some of my deep-seated but largely forgotten insecurities about how I was supposed to show up in my body when it came to physical appearance.
Elise once worked as a teenage model, but by the time she went to college, she'd felt it was something that was very much in her past.
I ultimately came to this kind of detente with appearance culture where I thought, you know what, I'm not going to participate in this. And so I understood that for myself, but I didn't think about it kind of in the larger scheme of the experiences for all of us, for my community or just for women broadly. until I moved to Seoul, where people didn't seem to be shy about talking about your looks rather loudly. So I was approached about my freckles a lot. I have freckles. It's no big deal. I've never thought they were a big deal. In fact, I thought they were cute. But a lot of Koreans would just be like, ooh, freckles. We can fix that for you. The rise of K-culture, K-beauty, but also K-pop, K-film, K-drama. And all of these things, as it turns out, are interrelated, which I then got to take a deep dive into after I moved back and repatriated to the United States.
I think we're throwing around the term K-beauty a lot, and it's something that I'm super familiar with, partly because I love my products, partly because I work in magazines. But for those who maybe don't actually really know what the term covers, could you demystify it a little bit?
For me, I describe K-beauty as anything that includes products from Korea, cosmetics, skincare, treatments, tools, and procedures. So Korea is one of the leading exporters of cosmetics in the world, behind just the US and France. So it is the world's third largest exporter of cosmetics. The most sophisticated surgeries and innovation in procedures for skin and for body are happening in South Korea, which is one of the most advanced and sophisticated cosmetic surgery markets in the world. And so Korean surgery also falls in K-beauty, in my definition. What was different about Korea was how explicit the lookism was. It's called lookism there. It's appearance-based discrimination. So passport photos come photoshopped by default when you go and get your photo taken. They automatically photoshop them. Headshots are required on resumes for government jobs, for accounting jobs, for non-modeling jobs. Headshots will often come on resumes. Koreans will refer to their physical selves with the term specs. Specs that we use to describe computers or gadgets, like, oh, I'm going to improve my specs. What are your specs? So there was a lot of just diagnosis, a lot of ratios and lines of the correct ratios for your face, the correct lines that your silhouette should look like, the correct lines and ratios for the thickness of your calf. And then when doctors and industry kind of established those standards, they could then sell you the surgery or the procedure or the injectable or the treatment to fix it, to get to the ideal.
It's not just residents of Korea committing to these sorts of procedures. Travelers are also coming from all around the world for shopping and medical tourism, sometimes even starting the process before they've left the airport.
You can get off the plane at Incheon Airport and go to their medical tourism center, which is right at the airport, and get a skin analysis. So you're getting a skin analysis in one of those giant, like, multi-$1,000 machines, which they're like, ooh, you should probably fix this. You know, like, oh, I can really see those UV damage in this particular part of your cheek.
That is wild. I also can't think of anything worse than getting off a flight from, like, New York to Seoul.
And then getting your...
like, stuff of nightmares.
So there are these brokers, there's an entire network of brokers who offer concierge services to those outside of Korea, so to foreigners, to come into Korea to get a suite of treatments. There's concierge brokers that provide translation services. If you do choose a surgery, they can kind of be at your side and be the first people that you see when you come out of anesthesia. And all of these brokers are paid for by the doctors. So you pay nothing for all of this extra translation and concierge help. And I write in the book, you know, when you're not paying for the product, you might be the product. This is something that is really deliberate to try and lure people into Korea.
A big theme of Elise's book is the research and development into technical innovations by beauty brands and the rapid introduction of new products into the market.
Increasingly, that lens that we are having to kind of be seen through is technological. It is algorithms. It is AI. As technology improves, we are also forced to improve with it because it shows us ever narrowing and cyborgian and sometimes alarming standards for what we're supposed to look like. And so one of the big themes is asking this question again and again of where do we draw the line when technology makes our standards ever out of reach? But technology also presents us with more and more ways to change our physical bodies to reach those standards.
Coming up, Elise tells me about some of the women she interviewed for the book and shares their stories.
What were some of the most memorable conversations you had, and who were a few of the women across those generations that I guess like made the biggest impression on you or shifted your way of thinking in some way?
Oh gosh, that's hard. I mean, obviously I loved speaking with the spunky second graders, you know, and they were just telling me about how a lot of their friends already start wearing bright colored lipstick to school. And then there's actually lip tint pockets in their school uniform. They're kind of encouraged to start doing some aesthetic labor, even when they're in elementary school. But some of my favorite people that I talked to were the activists, the women who are now in their 20s, but came to feminism, I guess, in their late teens when they started participating in the Escape the Corset movement. It's called Escape the Corset, and it's obviously a figurative corset. But they were part of those big historic feminist rallies in 2018. And they all talked about how they began to feel self-conscious about their looks. To a person, they talked about the need to have to change their appearance. That started when they themselves were 7 or 8 years old. A lot of them talked about being teased and being called monkey or gorilla for being too hairy when they were just children. A lot of them talked about kind of getting into a cycle of spending a lot of money and a lot of time in front of mirrors, and how that really felt like a trap that they couldn't escape because there was no other way. Like, they felt like it was empowering and they were empowered by trying to look their best and spend a bunch of money and time improving their appearance. But it was also not a choice because this was demanded professionally, you know, just to get a job. It was also demanded of them by their family members who were constantly like, oh, let me gift you cosmetic surgery for a graduation, or let me help you get a leg up.
Here's a short passage from Flawless, featuring one of the women Elise talked to about what happens when lookism is enforced within the family.
Hae-in Shim, 27, recalls being in middle school when her father started showing her Miss Korea pageants on television. She grew up in Gwangju, a metropolis in the southern part of the country. For nights on end, she says, she sat in her living room after dinner as her dad played on repeat a video of pageant contestants walking in their bikinis and high heels to, quote, teach me how to walk, she says. Then I had to walk in front of my dad with this video every night to be a good daughter. What if you refused, I asked. Said she feared her parents would have shamed her and starved her had she disobeyed. They kind of were starving me already. I remember every morning my mom and dad would talk about how big my legs were, how big my stomach was, saying, she's not going to get picked as a wife later. Her example is not unusual for her generation. With the emphasis on beauty as an instrument to both social and economic success playing out inside many families.
In interview after interview, Elise heard how women were turning away from what was expected of them.
They decided not to participate anymore. They were like, you know what? We're going to participate in essentially what's a general strike against aesthetic labor. They cut off their hair, shorn it really short. They crushed their compacts on social media, and they found community in one another. And it ended up being really beneficial to their mental health because there is a real stigma against getting therapy in South Korea. And not a lot of mental health resources. And so finding each other and this activism was actually a way for them to support one another's souls, you know, without sounding too woo-woo. And it was just really, I thought, for me, nourishing and fortifying to hear from them.
We keep coming back to these rallies that took place in 2018. And I'm assuming that everything you were just describing was a large impetus for why they took place. But was there like a specific turning point that, you know, when I think of here in the US, there's usually,
yeah,
when it comes to any sort of like bit large social movement or uprising and protesting, there's usually one considerable moment that sparks it.
Yeah, there were two, and both happened. There's probably a lot more, and so I don't want to make it sound as though these were the only galvanizing incidents. There was a murder of a woman. So it was violence were both of the reasons, both of the impetus. So there was the killing, the stabbing death of a woman in a public bathroom just outside the Gangnam subway station, and Gangnam famous from the song. And famous for being just one of the most posh districts in Seoul.
And a huge tourist destination.
Huge tourist destination. And the man who did it, he waited in the bathroom. There were CCTV cameras that showed he let all sorts of men pass by without attacking them, and then waited for a woman victim, attacked the woman victim with a knife and killed her, and later said, I killed her because she's a woman. And so that was particularly galvanizing, and it began a lot of feminist sort of community building in online spaces and offline spaces. There's also an epidemic of spy cam porn, which is something I hadn't heard of before, but it's the same reason that you cannot buy an iPhone in South Korea or Japan that allows for you to take photos without the loud camera sound, the clicking sound. You can't turn it off because there was such an epidemic of upskirting and secret filming.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it's called Molka. And tiny pinhole cameras would be installed by the perpetrators of this particular crime in places like changing rooms, in public bathrooms, in restaurants, in subway stations, just everywhere. And then these unwitting victims of spy cam porn, they were often, you know, changing clothes or undressing, right? In a public bathroom stall, for example. These videos would then get sold on various porn hubs for folks who wanted to see this kind of content, just random, strange women being filmed without their consent. It also happened in intimate relationships, a lot of revenge porn, a lot of secret filming of sex and just private moments inside homes. And the people doing it were everybody from like bus drivers to church pastors. Like, this was just a huge problem, and it was happening all over the place. But rarely, rarely prosecuted. So it was functionally legal until 2018, when a woman secretly filmed a nude male model in an art class, and she got prosecuted. She almost instantly got prosecuted. And so this actually led a lot of women out into the streets.
I mean, essentially, you've written a book about beauty, but you've written a book about so much more. And really, it's a book about gender inequity.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks.
You know, not to be all doom and gloom.
It also is a fun and heartwarming book. There is a lot of my family in it. And then what I do celebrate about Touch of Beauty Workers, I still love getting a facial. I'm not somebody who completely eschews beauty rituals. I just think we need to break the link between ourselves and our physical selves. Like, yourself is so much more nuanced than what you see.
What do you hope readers glean from your book? You know, what do you hope that they, especially, I think, you know, both Koreans and non-Koreans, because really reading it's probably going to be quite a different experience.
Yeah, I think reflection is really important, right? Like, ask yourself who you're trying to be, because sometimes I want to buy something because it feels like it's a step further into myself. And other times when I make a choice of buying something to change my appearance, it's an attempt to be more like someone else, or it's an attempt to not get judged. And so distinguishing whether your choices are ego-driven or truly soul-driven is what requires awareness that I talked about. And it's something that you can kind of just take a quiet moment and really ask yourself.
I feel like we covered so much ground.
It was a wide-ranging podcast episode, everybody. Hang on to your hats.
Yeah, exactly. And then hopefully buy some sunscreen, which I am 34 and have become diligent about my
sunscreen. Good. And look at your skin.
Sunscreen.
You may not see her, but I can. And wow, look at that glowy skin. You're looking great.
Look, I just got back from vacation. So it's, you know, I've had a week of not being under this fluorescent lighting, and it did wonders for me. Thanks to Elise for her storytelling and insights, which made me even more fascinated and eager to experience Seoul. And restock my cabinet with some brand new sunscreens. Next week, rewilding huge areas of Argentina and Chile. I'm Lale Arakoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hanna. Our engineers are Jake Loomis and Gabe Kuroga. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Duke Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. See you next week.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.